Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, welcome everyone to this Federalist Society virtual event. As today, March 1st, 2021, we have a Courthouse Steps oral argument review of United States v. Arthrex. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on today's call are those of our experts. And we're very pleased to be joined by a great panel today. I'm just going to introduce our moderator and she'll take it from there. And we're pleased to be joined today by Professor Kristen Osenga. She's Austin E. Owen Research Scholar and Professor of Law at the University of Richmond School of Law. So with that, Kristen, thanks very much for being with us. The floor is yours.
Great. Thanks, Nick. As Nick said, I'm Kristen Osenga from the University of Richmond School of Law. And I am joined today with two of my friends and colleagues. We have Professor Greg Dolan from the University of Baltimore School of Law, who is also an Associate Justice at the Supreme Court of the Republic of Palau, and Dimitri Karstedt, who is a professor at George Washington University School of Law. You can learn more about each of them by clicking the links on the page that you access this webinar from. So this is a Courthouse Steps webinar about the U.S. Supreme Court case of the United States versus Arthrex that was argued this morning, March 1st, 2021. For this webinar, I'm going to briefly lay out the issue in the Arthrex case before turning it over to Greg and Dimitri, who will each give you their impressions of how the Supreme Court arguments went this morning. And after that, each of them will provide you their predictions for what the outcome will be and their viewpoints on the case more generally. We'll hopefully have some time to turn it over for audience questions in the last 10 to 15 minutes. So the Arthrex case is an important one for patent law, but it may have broader implications because it's really a separation of powers issue. In 2011, as part of the Leahy-Smith America Invents Act, or the AIA, a board known as the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, which we like to call the PTAB, at least I call it the PTAB, was created as a faster and cheaper alternative to litigation. The PTAB, through a couple of post-patent grant procedures, is able to determine whether one or more claims of an issued patent is invalid. Since 2012, when the PTAB was implemented, it has happily embraced this task, invalidating more than 2,000 issued patents. Some critics have even dubbed the PTAB a death squad for this reason. To be fair, in recent years, under previous Patent Office Director Iancu, the number of institutions and invalidations has gone down. So much so that, in fact, there is lawsuits have been filed complaining that the Patent Office's discretionary decisions not to institute post-grant proceedings is problematic. But the political winds have shifted, so who knows what the future will hold for the Patent Office, and we may yet be headed back towards the death squad days of yore. In any case, while there have been many complaints about the PTAB's zeal in invalidating patents, and now their lack of zeal in instituting these challenges, and also concerns about the PTAB's process, which many say is stacked against the patent owner, those concerns are not an issue in the Arthrex case. Rather, the issue today is whether the administrative patent judges, or APJs, who comprise the PTAB, are principal officers, thus requiring presidential appointment and Senate confirmation, or whether they are inferior offices that can be simply appointed. If the APJs are principal officers, their appointment by the head of the department, specifically the Secretary of Commerce, in consultation with the head of the agency, specifically the director of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, is unconstitutional. So the patent infringement part of this case is not really relevant, except to explain how this case came to the Supreme Court. Arthrex had a patent. It was issued by the United States Patent and Trademark Office. Arthrex sued Smith & Nephew in district court, alleging infringement of that patent. Smith & Nephew then filed a petition at the Patent Office seeking to invalidate a number of claims of the patent. A 3-APJ panel of the PTAB issued a decision holding the claims invalid. Arthrex then appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, arguing that the appointment of the APJs to the PTAB violated the Appointments Clause, or Clause 2 of Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution. This provision requires principal officers to be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, while the appointment of inferior officers can be delegated to, as relevant in this case, department heads without Senate confirmation. Arthrex argued that the PTAB judges are principal officers, and the Federal Circuit agreed. The precedent that the Federal Circuit applied considers the extent of the decisional authority of the officer in their role, as well as the amount of supervision and control over the officer in question by an officer that was him or herself presidentially nominated or Senate confirmed. Canceling issued patents provides APJs a significant amount of decisional power in their role, and the PTAB decisions are not reviewable by the Patent Office Director. On the other hand, the director who is nominated and confirmed does have authority over the selection of PTAB panels and the rules under which the APJs operate. On balance, however, the Federal Circuit decided that APJs were principal officers. Also at issue in this case is whether the Federal Circuit's fix was an appropriate one. After finding that, as it were, the PTAB APJs were principal officers, the Federal Circuit simply made them inferior officers by severing their tenure protection in order to save the entire statutory scheme. The appellate court then remanded the case to a new panel of now newly inferior APJs. Interestingly, all three parties, Arthrex, Smith and Nephew, and the government, which had intervened in the Federal Circuit case to defend the constitutionality of the APJs, all three parties petitioned for certiorari at the Supreme Court. Now, without saying anything about this case, I was always told that if no one is happy, we probably have found the right answer. And with that, I will turn it over to my esteemed colleagues to tell you whether or not this is the right answer and what the Supreme Court might do about it. And I will turn it first over to Dimitri.
All right. Thanks, Kristen, for that introduction. And thanks for the Federalist Society for having me on this panel. This is a very exciting case. And I think it's one of those cases where the argument was extremely illuminating, kind of starting from the end of your discussion. I think no one on the court liked the remedy that the Federal Circuit adopted. And the real close case will be obviously the substantive issue underlying whether there was an appointments clause violation here. I'll get to the argument in a little bit, especially I think the exchanges with Justice Kagan for both private parties' lawyers were very illuminating, kind of on the history and whether the Patent Office deviates from it and whether the practice of speaking for the government without a person being a principal officer is historically established or not. But I'll start with sort of making some arguments, I think, as to why the Federal Circuit should be reversed in this case. And full disclosure, I signed a brief of constitutional, intellectual property, and administrative law professors. So arguing, but here I'm just speaking, of course, for myself. So I'll talk about four basic issues here, right? One is significant authority issue. What is significant authority for principal officer designation? One is what is supervision? So it's looking at from the director side, right? What constitutes appropriate supervision for appointments clause purposes? And then kind of the three and a four I'll talk about are structural and sort of jurisprudential issues. Like the third thing is deference to Congress. How much deference should there be given to Congress in these sort of constitutional reviews? And fourth is sort of this idea of constitutionalization of history. Where does that get us? So let's start with the significant authority part of it. It cannot be that just speaking for the government is already significant authority. I mean, plenty, as Justice Breyer indicated, plenty of officials make final and binding decisions on the behalf of the government. It cannot all be principal officers, right? So what is the test, right? The authority has to be not only significant, right? Significant authority makes one an inferior officer. It has to be uber significant or more or somewhat or extremely significant for the person to be a principal officer, right? So what does that mean in practice? I mean, we have some examples, even though this case is not binding a Supreme Court, right? Copyright royalty judges in the intercollegiate case were setting rates that were affecting entire industries and so on. And the DC Circuit there thought that this was a significant exercise of authority. I'm not so sure a run-of-the-mill patent, and there are millions of patents being issued, applying law to the facts of the case constitutes a significant exercise of authority and actually extremely significant for the principal officer status on behalf of the United States. This is mere, you know, not rote, obviously, there's judgment involved, but this is basically adjudication of cases under a precedent that the director sets, under precedential law from the Federal Circuit. Of course, the legal judgments are open to de novo review from the Federal Circuit. So I'm not sure if this is significant authority. And yes, I mean, as the brief Arthur argues, you can lose a case, you can lose a lot of money as an individual party if your patent gets wiped out. That's absolutely true. But I think probably the framers come to play to something a little bit more. And this, we hear that in cases like Morrison v. Olson, right? Authority to formulate policy for the government or the executive branch. That gets me to the second point. And the second point relates to, we're talking about supervision here. We're talking about micromanagement, because Arthur's position is very much the micromanagement side. Not only do they get, you know, does the director set, you know, precedence to presidential opinion panels and so on, but also they have to review, you know, potentially every decision in great detail. I think supervision doesn't have to extend to that, right? The director has discretionary power to institute, where actually the director makes a decision where the claims are more likely than not unpatentable. That, you know, very much biases the decision toward a result. But that's the director's judgment, right? That's the director's judgment, the initial institution judgment. And where it's sort of the political power exercises, that is discretionary denials that a lot of people are up in our arms against. But that is, I think, sufficient supervision for constitutional purposes. You don't have to sort of direct or manage every step of the way and then look at the APJ's drafts closely or something like that to have that level of supervision. There are plenty of ways in which directors supervise opinions. And if the opinions are being important, like the RPX opinion involving real party and interest, then the director can put himself or herself on the panel and the chief APJ and so on and make sure that that significant case comes out the way the director thinks it does. I'm not sure, a run-of-the-mill patent that's disposed by APJ has that level of significance or requires that level of supervision. So the last couple of points, like the deference point. In our brief, we argued that it can't be that this analysis should be subject to sort of an open-ended multi-factor test where all these considerations are in play. Here we have inter-branch agreement. Now, this is not the Morrison v. Olson situation where, even though the court allowed the independent counsel there, right, a Congress passed along, the president signed the law designating these officers as inferior. And I think that requires some amount of deference, just like we do in other constitutional type cases. Now, we argued for simplifying the test. I mean, if it's sort of fairly debatable whether an officer is principal or inferior, I think the officer, in respect to Congress, I think the Supreme Court should uphold the statutory scheme allowed. So that was a big point in our brief. It didn't come up so much in the argument, but the idea of a multi-factor test providing little guidance to Congress as to who is inferior and who is a principal officer seems like an awful way to run a constitutional system. And Justice Thomas in particular was asking about a more bright line test. And Justice Sotomayor said she has friends in the court, colleagues who like bright line tests. So maybe there's a potential for agreement there, whichever way that comes out. My final point is sort of this constitutionalization of history point. There's a lot in Arthur's brief about how this patent office system is unique without sort of intra-agency review. At the same time, right, if you're going to constitutionalize history that way, you have to also accept numerous examples of various government members of the government making final and binding decisions. And the Arthur's brief sort of knocks them down one by one, saying they're too obscure or too recent or too unimportant. But that's Greg will appreciate the Russian saying, right, this was a long time ago and not true type of argument, kind of knocked them down by one. And actually, major cases like Kroll v. Benson, for example, had where there was a kitchen sink of constitutional arguments, had someone, a deputy commissioner, that was making these binding decisions for the government, and that was not challenged, and that was around for a long time. So I think the constitutionalization of history cuts both ways, and that gets me to the Justice Kagan's questions, right? She asked both parties, right? She asked Smith and Nephew's lawyer, is the patent office unique? Is it a different animal? Of course, it's sort of an administrative agency that predates the APA, and structures are very different. She also asked of Arthur's lawyer, you know, what about all these other examples? Are all these people principal officers? They make final decisions for the government. And I think the question has to come down, you know, what is really significant authority? I've told you which side I fall on in this sort of analysis. I'm sure Greg falls on the other side, but I think at least it's sort of a matter of degree that we can, you know, reasonably disagree about. The court will reasonably disagree about it, and there'll be a close case.
Fantastic. I mean, before I turn it over to Greg, I just wanted to follow up with you, Dimitri. You mentioned the brief you filed. So just to give you credit for it, who did you file a brief with on behalf of whatever?
So the brief was led by my colleague, Alan Morrison, who argued cases like INS v. Chadha and I believe Edmund too. So I will defer to him for administrative law expertise. I helped a lot with IP. Other joiners to the brief were another one of my colleagues, Robert Glucksmann, who is also an administrative law scholar. And on the IP side, there were Mark Lemley and George Sarnoff. Mark Lemley of Stanford, George Sarnoff of DePaul.
Great. So just in case people want to read your argument more in more detail. Okay, with that, let me turn it over to Greg to give his viewpoint of what happened this morning.
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you for the kind introduction. And thank you to the Federalist Society. It's always a pleasure to be back at one of these teleforums. It's often a highlight of, at least for me, of a Supreme Court term, in part because I can share my views of the case as well as kind of make myself listen to the oral arguments sooner than I otherwise would. Let me also, before I begin, in the interest of full disclosure, I'll also disclose that I filed a brief, an amicus brief in this case, half disagreeing with Dimitri's position. So I was on the other side. I was filed in support of Arthrex, but I think both of us agree, and Dimitri didn't talk much about remedy, and I will, but both of us agree that the remedy that the Federal Circuit came up with, kind of making APJs fireable at will, is, and perhaps we came up to that result for different reasons, but that's a incorrect remedy. But let me take a slightly different tack from Dimitri just for purposes of elucidating the matter for the, for our listeners. And I will touch on in response to some of Dimitri's arguments, but let me kind of just run through fairly quickly on the argument itself for and kind of my takeaways from it. So let me begin with sort of just nose counting, and then I'll sort of dive into why I think this is the way it is. So although it's a fool's errand, I know, Kristen, you promised people that maybe we'll end by predicting the results. I'm not a gambling man, and so I wouldn't wager much on my own prediction, but nonetheless, a bit of a gut feeling given the oral argument. So I think Chief Justice Roberts, Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch were fairly concerned with the structure of PTAB and the fact that APJs do make these decisions. And again, like I said, I'll get into whether or not these are significant or insignificant, but they do make these final decisions for the government without their decisions being subject to review. Justice Gorsuch especially kept hammering the Malcolm Stewart, who represented the government, on this issue of reviewability of decisions, and would not accept an answer, Mr. Stewart's answer that removability and kind of the punishment, the stick, is a sufficient level of control. He wanted to know whether or not decision itself is subject to review. Justice Kavanaugh as well, he quoted Justice Scalia's famous Senator Morrison versus Olson, said like, look, maybe this rule doesn't quite come as a rule, but it comes, not all that disguised either. So, and he was very sort of open with his cards on the table that this concerns him. Justice Roberts also, I think, gave the government a bit of a hard time. A couple of others were also easy to read on the other side. I think Justice Breyer was basically like just came out of the gates. He thinks the entire line of cases about the officer of the United States was wrongly decided, including PCAOB and I think Sale of Law. And so he's just not a fan of constitutionalizing these, what he thinks are really government employees as opposed to officers. Justice Kagan, I thought, was initially kind of skeptical of PTAB when she questioned Malcolm Stewart, but then, I think became even more skeptical of Arthur's position as well. Like Dimitri pointed out that, she gave a bunch of both historical and current examples of similar type of officers or employees or however you want to classify them that are not subject to Senate confirmation and are not subject to necessarily significant control. She did express some concern about kind of the uniqueness of PTO and PTAB. But I think as Dimitri pointed out again in this conversation as well as in our private conversation beforehand, that may be kind of the nature of the beast of PTAB. And if anything, that, patent office is unique in both directions, both kind of on cancellation of patents and as on kind of on the grant of patents. And kind of Dimitri can speak for himself if he wants to sort of develop that line of thought. And then I think there were like three justices who were, Justice Thomas, I think, also initially started with you know, being somewhat skeptical of the argument that advanced by the government. But ultimately, I think we'll come down on government side. I think Justice Thomas, both partially based on his questioning, as well as kind of his history of being fairly open to the PTAB style creation. After all, he authored the opinion in Oil States, which upheld PTAB against the constitutional challenge that patents can only be invalidated in Article III tribunals as opposed to administrative processes. So that leaves open kind of the big question marks, leaves open Justice Alito and Justice Barrett. Again, if I were a betting man, and I'm not, I think they probably lean towards Arthrex. But, you know, I think a lot will come out in opinion writing and kind of a more exploration of history. So that's kind of, I think, how the argument went. I think, for example, just a couple of highlights. I think Justice Alito, for example, was really sort of concerned with this lack of bright light test. He started reading to, I forget whether it was to government attorney or to attorney for Smith's nephew, he basically started reading a list, this kind of this laundry list that the government submitted, saying, look at all these ways that APJs are controlled by the superior officers, such as patent office director. They're like, well, what if I take this one away and this one away and this one away? When will we be on the other side of the line? And, I don't think he got a satisfactory response. In fact, I think kind of the maximalist position advanced by Smith and nephew, which essentially boiled down to anybody who's not in the cabinet or heading an independent agency, by definition, not a principal officer, I don't think we'll have any buyers, maybe save for Justice Breyer. And Justice Barrett as well. I think she kind of was the same sort of a way. I think she was thumb on a scale for Arthrex, but ultimately I think will come out in the writing. So again, if gun to the head, I had to predict, I think it would be kind of 5-4 affirming the Federal Circuit on the violation, but I think 0-9 on affirming the Federal Circuit on the remedy. I think the remedy would be quite different. With that, let me kind of, and we can talk more about what the remedy might be, or whether or not there will be a remedy, or just kind of the court will kick the can down to Congress. But let me kind of just answer a couple of Dimitri's points, because I think they're important, and I think they're well thought out. I think they're important, but ultimately, I am not convinced. One, I think the Constitution can be run on the. So let me actually take a step back. Let me say where I am. Where I am in agreement with Dimitri. I think he's right that not every decision that's ever made by the federal government is a decision that must be made by a principal officer. So, for example, Justice Breyer made some, I think ultimately silly hypotheticals, but they make a point. So, like, just because a doctor at a VA hospital makes an appointment for you, and that's a kind of a decision, and that you have to show up, especially if you're applying for disability benefits, and if you blow off that appointment, you may not get your benefits. I don't think that, the scheduling of your appointment must be done by an officer of any kind, much less a principal officer. So I think that's right. So there's got to be some sort of significance to the decision. At the same time, I don't think you can run a constitution on the basis of kind of ex post figuring out, is this patent really important or is it not really important? So I think we kind of have to decide, are patent rights important? And maybe sort of, Dimitri thinks that there are some, not important enough, especially since, there's contravailing considerations about precluding others in the public from practicing the patent, basically limiting their rights. And so, and I think that's, entirely legitimate position to take, maybe one that I will disagree with, but I don't think we can sort of do kind of ex post. We can either say like, look, patents are the type of decisions that should be done by principal officers or should not be done by principal officers. In the brief that I filed on behalf of Cato and myself, and hopefully if Ilya Shapiro is on the call, who was a co-counsel on the brief, he will see that I'm not hopefully misrepresenting Cato's position in this brief. It's that it's somewhat odd to have a patent issued by a principal officer, which maybe in name only, but nonetheless the patent is signed by the director of the patent office, to only to be canceled by non-principal officers. It's an odd, to quote Justice Kagan, it's an odd bird. And so ultimately, I think that if it's kind of done by a principal officer on the front and it has to be done by a principal officer on the back end. Dimitri also says, relies on a couple of times he cited Morrison versus Olson, which, to be fair, is still good law, but, it's certainly a much criticized law. So, and I think more and more people are of the view that it was wrongly decided. I think I'm one of those people. So I don't know how much water, I mean, again, it is certainly good law. It is certainly decided, but it has not been formally overruled. But ultimately, I don't know how much weight that case can hold. And again, and then this issue of congressional deference, certainly I think there must be a presumption of constitutionality to any act that the Congress passes. We must presume both as a legal matter, but also as a general matter, something that I think we've been losing in our society generally, that political actors and legal actors are acting in good faith, they're acting kind of with deference to what they think the Constitution allows and permits and requires. And so there's got to be some deference to Congress. But at the same time, in a separation of power cases where, you know, one branch is trying to aggrandize to themselves power, it's exactly one of those cases where I think scrutiny has to be searching. And finally, I do, you know, to kind of the point where I violently agree with Dimitri is this. So the multi-factor test is a bit of a problem because it doesn't give any guidance to anyone. It's kind of just throw a whole bunch of things up against the wall and see what sticks. The Cato brief proposed a bright line test, drawing on work by Professor Gary Lawson, saying that in order for somebody to be an inferior officer, the decision itself has to be reviewable, and not just have there be a threat of termination afterwards, or, you know, or reassignment to some other position or something else. You know, there may be other, you know, obviously Smith and Nephew proposed a bright line test that unless you're in a cabinet or head of an executive agency, you're not a principal officer. So there can be lots of bright line tests, but I think I'm much more in favor of bright line tests. And I think if nothing else, I would hope that that's kind of what the court comes up with. No guarantees, but if ultimately I think, Kristen may be incorrect in her introduction that this is an important case of patent law. It might actually be very unimportant case for patent law because even a restructured board might ultimately reject this particular patent and not much might change on the ground, but it might ultimately be a much more important case for admin law than it is for patent law. So with that, I think I'll turn it over back to Kristen for, you know, to either follow up questions or to open it up to the public, however she in her moderator capacity believes we should proceed.
Okay, well, thank you, Greg. So I think what I want to do first is give Dimitri just a minute or two to respond to any of the violent agreement I think you said you might have had with him. Maybe he needs to defend himself against violently agreeing with you. So Dimitri, any responses you have to what Greg said?
Sure. No, this is a very thoughtful response by Greg. And it sounds like we agree on a lot of things. For example, a bright line test. Just on the importance of it, I want to say that I think it depends on what is important. I think it's the issues that are important, not any individual patent. I mean, setting patent policy, you know, what a private party in interest, and that's extremely important. And that's something, but that's something the director can control. I mean, I think any individual patent, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, right, maybe has less of a degree of importance, right? And that's, that's where I stand. On Morrison, I actually think Scalia wrote a great dissent, but remember that deals with an interbranch disagreement, right? So an interbranch appointment. This is what Scalia's dissent says, where the issue pertains to separation of powers and the political branches are in disagreement, neither can be presumed correct. For the AIA, both branches were in agreement, and in fact, violent agreement. I think the vote was like 89-10, and then the president signed it without any threat of a veto. So we're talking about, you know, some kind of deference to the political branches as to whether they know what they're doing when they're designating officer status, which I guess leads to my third point. Yes, we don't want, you know, a review that's complete, has no teeth whatsoever, but we're talking about issues that are reasonably debatable, like significance, you know, of individual patents versus issues. So what is significant authority? I think maybe some deference should be given to Congress. Again, our bright line test is in our brief is essentially sort of a strong presumption of constitutionality of things like this. I don't think the Federal Circuit discussed any presumption of constitutionality in any context. You know, I realize that this sort of constitutional challenge is not subject to, you know, rational basis review and levels of scrutiny the way the fundamental rights are. But I think there's got to be some thumb on the scale in favor of the political branches where they agree, unlike in Morrison, where there was an interbranch appointment. Right. So but overall, I think it's become clear that a clear test is necessary after this argument, so Congress can legislate in the background of this constitutional law. And I mean, I think one approach here, the court really didn't want to blow up the system. You could see that in the end. I mean, in Northern Pipeline, the court stayed the judgment for Congress to fix the situation. There was a, we'll probably discuss this more, but Congress already fixed the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board by providing a review in the director of TTAB decisions. Maybe the same could be done here, so this, you know, this kind of thing can go away, right? Obviously, it's an important structural limit, but it is fixable, right? You know, to the extent the director can delegate everything to the board anyway, right? It's not clear, you know, if the fix is actually somewhat meaningful from a constitutional perspective. Arthrex's argument was that it was because there's more accountability and so on, and I take that point, I think we'll have to see. I think the Supreme Court did not really want to get into a remedy, and maybe this will discuss this more because it just seems like a mess. You know, the Federal Circuit's approach was not favored, but then, you know, blue penciling director review, especially when Congress already provided in a very similar context actual director review or some kind of rehearing, you know, opportunity for a hearing and so on, becomes like judicial legislation. So that's the problem we're facing. The court doesn't want to do it, but the court, as Gray correctly said, I think you can count five justices at least have serious doubts about the constitutionality of the scheme, in which case they'll have to confront it in some way. Maybe the Northern Pipeline approach of staying the judgment and getting Congress to act would be the best way to handle it.
Okay, so I promised people a prediction. Greg didn't predict, but then he threw out 5409. So, Dimitri, do you have any numbers you want to throw out as a prediction, and then I'll ask you guys some questions.
I can see a 5-4 to reverse because Arthrex's counsel basically said there is no acceptable remedy. I think that was going that the court can give, right? Only congressional remedy, and the court didn't really want to fund this to Congress. So maybe for that reason, I would say it's a 5-4 reverse, right? And then that's the case, then no remedy is necessary. So I'm evading your second question. If it comes out the other way around, if it's an affirm, then who knows? I think my prediction would almost be to stay the judgment for which there's precedent, because the court doesn't want to get into the business of legislating and writing proper constitutional schemes here.
Okay. Well, you know, since you said you didn't want to talk about remedies, let's talk about remedies. So a question, you know, for both of you. So if this is not the right remedy, and it sounds like you're in agreement that this is not the right remedy, a couple of different things have popped up through this conversation. They could make it like the TTAB with the director review. They could stay it and let Congress fix it. But what would be the best fix there to fix the problem? I mean, yes, I know Congress can fix it, but what would you have them do? And as far as the TTAP with the director review of it, I'm wondering if that doesn't get us back up into some of the issues that people have said that it's so stacked against the patent holder because the institution decision is already at the director level. So isn't that basically saying the director of the patent office would institute this and then he would review whether or not the patent's found invalid? It sounds like we're putting an inordinate amount of power with the director then. So I'll go ahead and turn it to Greg first. What's your favored remedy if this is found to be unconstitutional, and how would that work?
Well, you know, I think there's my favorite remedy, and you know, and I think what's plausible and what kind of within the context of this having been upheld before. Anybody who's ever read my writings or even my briefs knows that I'm not no fan of PTAB, and I think it should have been struck down back when the court was discussing oil states. So my favorite remedy is this all goes away and we go back to the way things were before AIA. But you know, I don't think that's realistic. So in our brief, we urged the court not to come up with a remedy. We sort of pointed out some potential ones, but sort of said it's not for the court to write. One potential remedy is kind of having the director, so creating two additional principal officers. So director is already a principal officer, and making perhaps commissioner of patent, also Senate confirmed, as well as the chief judge of the PTAB. And that way they would constitute that, you know, presidential opinion panel who in that case, kind of they would be able to really review any decision, either for law or facts or whatever else they wanted. The fact that they don't do it for every decision, as I think Arthur's counsel suggested, that, you know, Supreme Court also doesn't review every decision that comes out from the federal courts. And, you know, I think that would be fine. If that were the case, perhaps for due process concerns, so as not to be, you know, not to subject the patents to political pressure, perhaps those individuals, at least two of them, could serve at some sort of like set term. So that, you know, the president can't just call up and say, look, I don't like Apple, or, you know, I don't like Twitter because they kicked me off. And so I wanted, like, you know, Twitter patents canceled. So something along those lines. Obviously, this is not something the court can come up with. It's something that Congress has to do. And, you know, I actually haven't thought that Dmitry, as usual, helps me sort of think through some issues and remind me of some other cases that I haven't even thought about. But I completely forgot about the stay of judgment in Northern Pipeline. And I think that is a plausible way to go, give Congress opportunity to fix it, you know, and perhaps also add some sort of bipartisanship to Washington, because this was a bipartisan bill. Maybe this is could be another one of those feel-good legislations where everybody can get on board and fix a constitutional problem. Perhaps too much to hope for, but, you know, that would be sort of favored within the reality of possible. I think that probably would be my favorite remedy. Let me just add one quick thing, and I apologize. The reason I think Mitra and I, or the reason at least I think the remedy is that the Federal Circuit came up with is inappropriate, that it really doesn't fix the problem. So if the problem is that the decision is not, you know, that the what makes somebody a superior officer or principal officer is the fact that their decision is not reviewable. And in this case, APJ's decision is not reviewable, then making APJ's terminable at will or not at will in any way, like, doesn't really address that point. Now, if that's not a problem, then it's just hard. Then it's hard to see how Arthur's case holds up overall. So that's why, like, it's in Congress, or to use the law professor, or is it favored by law professors, the remedy is entirely orthogonal to the problem identified by the Federal Circuit by Arthur.
Go ahead, Dmitry.
All right, thanks. I think we actually said this. I was going to jump in a brief, like, the remedy and the constitutional judgment have nothing to do with one another. I think that language comes from our brief too. But no, this is, Kristen, this is a great question. It sort of allows for a little bit of speculation, but maybe let me just kind of start with this idea that, you know, the PTO under these approaches can't win, right? If you fix the appointments clause problem, then the director all of a sudden has too much power and maybe subject to political wins. If you give APJ some independence, well, all of a sudden this is an appointments clause problem, which makes you wonder, you know, are we trying to get the system that works, or we just don't like the PTAB? And maybe the answer is we don't like the PTAB. I filed a brief challenging PTAB to an oil state. So on that issue, I was 100% with Greg, but I don't think, you know, we should be trying to bring down the PTAB by any means necessary. And then on this issue, I agree with the government. So in terms of fixes, I think the TTAB fix is acceptable. I think what's holding it up, though, is just patent law tends to be much more controversial than trademark law. And of course, the stakeholders and the senators who are interested in the issue, like Senator Tillis, will want that to be sort of a vehicle for more reform, like Section 101 reform, an issue that's near and dear to all of us, at least all three of us. So it can't just be a simple fix. There will be more opportunity for stakeholders to weigh in. And all of a sudden we have, you know, not just a quick fix, but big patent legislation. And maybe that is necessary, but maybe that will take a long time and generate some controversy, because in 2019, you know, we didn't get very far on 101 reform. So that's one potential question as to whether, you know, other things are going to come in. Now, in terms of Greg's point about having a director that is somewhat independent, I think it has a great deal of merit. And I think there's no reason why, if we have independent International Trade Commission, if we have an independent FTC, why can't the PTO director have that sort of independence, right? If you are setting policy that's important for the nation's commerce, but also want to be somewhat isolated from political winds, I can see legislation, or I can see support. And maybe that is our ultimate fix, to give the director power, but also some independence, where they can be insulated from this, you know, at least an attack or insinuation, or maybe it's real that they're being influenced by, you know, too much lobby or too much power. I mean, maybe that's okay, right? And ultimately the answer is political accountability, right? If you don't like the way the president is pushing the PTO, you can vote for someone else, but maybe that's not acceptable when it comes to sort of, at least what we want to be, a neutral adjudication, right? We don't want patent office to sort of favor one party's and not one party, some parties over others, and not apply the law. But at the same time, at least on policy, right, the patent office is historically, you know, they've historically asserted a position on Section 101, for example, no software patents or utility requirement for chemistry. So the patent office has always had that sort of policy drive. It didn't necessarily come from the president. It's unclear where it came from, but I think there's some value to having that under a political kind of under political control, as opposed to, of course, messing with individual determinations, kind of run-of-the-mill determinations, where I think don't make people, principal officers. I think that's unacceptable, and I think maybe that's part of the package of reform that we might see.
Okay, so not a whole lot of wherewithal to confirm every single APJ by the Senate. That's not the answer we're headed for either of you, I'm thinking.
Doesn't seem like it.
We have hard enough time confirming, Article 3 judges. I doubt that, Senate has time. Although I suppose minority party will always love it because it's just an opportunity to slow down everything else. So it's kind of one of those, filibuster pro kind of Senate being kind of a graveyard for lots of things, which, sometimes maybe good, sometimes maybe bad. One kind of quick response, Dmitry, is that, again, I'm of two minds on generally independent and tenured agency heads. I'm generally like the idea of political accountability, but that sort of goes back to, the problem with kind of the direct, that's kind of ultimately goes back to the problem that I'm having with administrative patent cancellations, which is on one hand, you want it to be insulated from political winds. On the other hand, you want the executive branch to be ultimately responsible to the president. And sometimes those two are not compatible. So, but if we accept that we are sort of stuck forever with at least some of our political appointees being tenured for some period of time, the only one concern is in making the director tenured is the sale of law, right? You cannot have a single director that is both tenured and kind of not part of a commission. So that's why I said perhaps make the commissioner of patents, so director perhaps not tenured, but commissioner of patents and say chief judge of the of PTAB tenured, plus the director who is not tenured, forming this kind of triumvirate that will be able to review decisions. So maybe that will pass constitutional muster. Again, I think there's lots of creative solutions that can be had. Dmitry and I are often in agreement, and I think here as well, I think our disagreement is mostly on the margin. I agree that, result doesn't justify, end doesn't justify the means, and we shouldn't take down, as much as I dislike PTAB, we shouldn't take it down by these, bad constitutional theories. So if the theory is bad just because you win, just Scalia was a look, a dictator can give you a, that's why, he said he adheres to the originalism and textualism, just because, a 5-member Supreme Court majority might occasionally reach good results doesn't mean that, we should be ruled by, 9 people in black robes. So I agree that we shouldn't kind of deform the Constitution in order to reach a good result with respect to PTAB. At the same time, I don't think that kind of holding the both branches, the federal executive branch and the federal legislative branch, to the requirement that people making big decisions be properly appointed, I don't think that actually is deforming the Constitution. And I think ultimately our disagreement with Dmitry is not even on that, but on kind of what counts as the big enough decision.
Okay, so we are starting to get some questions in the Q&A box. So I do invite the audience to go ahead and type their question into the Q&A box and we will answer some of those. I have my own questions for you guys, but I know both of you, so I'll just ask you later. So let's let our audience ask some questions. So I'm going to go ahead and pose these and let you guys go ahead and take a crack at them. So the first question we have is from Connor Kraft and asks, do you think the court's opinion will address the de facto officer doctrine at all? What do you think, guys?
Once I get hired to clerk for the Supreme Court, I'll be able to tell you better. But in the meantime, I suspect that there would be maybe a footnote explaining why the 2000 patent cancellations that you've mentioned at the opening of this teleforum are not, basically why those patents do not get revived. So there may be like a footnote with a nod to, de facto officer doctrine, something along those lines. I don't think there's going to be like a whole section dedicated to exploring this. That's not what cert was granted. That's not anything that was explored at oral argument. And although I haven't read all the amicus briefs, I don't think that's anything that was covered, at least in any great depth in any of the amicus briefs either.
Yeah, there was an amicus brief that maybe not through de facto officer doctrine, maybe it'll get us to the same result in this idea that once there's a judicial fix, right, it sort of applies retroactively and it actually doesn't require any remands or vacators because the decision was right ab initio. It's now like the judicial decision, and Andrew Michaels filed a brief on that point, right? A judicial decision sort of kicks in and all of a sudden fixes everything with a pizza. I'm not sure if I agree with that approach, but that could be a way to sort of, right, say, well, they're, you know, they're valid all along, even though, right, it confers validity. As I understand the doctrine, it confirms validity upon acts, even though it's later discovered that the official was not validly appointed or something. I don't know how much bite it modernly has, and I confess not knowing that much about the doctrine, but the retroactivity approach may sort of get us to the same result, but it wasn't really aired, it wasn't asked about, and it didn't seem like that was an important part of sort of the remedy or the court's consideration, right? I think the idea is these patents that are in limbo after the Federal Circuit's decision may, you know, continue to be in limbo. I'm not sure the court was kind of getting to in the direction of fixing that.
Okay. Our next question comes from Kevin Madigan and takes us into the world of copyright law. There will soon be an administrative tribunal established within the Copyright Office to hear small claims court cases. This Copyright Claims Board will be overseen by three officers who are appointed by the Librarian of Congress, who is herself a presidential appointee. I know that the CASE Act was specifically designed to avoid some of the constitutional concerns that have been raised in response to the PTAB, but I'm curious if you anticipate that there will be similar appointments clause constitutional challenges to the Copyright Claims Board. Thoughts, guys?
Nathan? It's another thing I sort of confess is outside entirely my area of expertise. I've followed intelligent discussions about the CASE Act by people like Zvi Rosen, who know more in this area than I do. I've read sort of read analysis, constitution analyses of it, and you know that there is right kind of a fairly narrow adjudicatory role. Maybe the fact that it's a small claims type, and I think it gets into sort of our question as to what is significant, right? But you know, to some people, those small claims are significant. I don't know, right? Patents is it a matter of a figure, right? Arthrex's brief says, well, there's going to be billions of dollars at stake, which is which is true, but do these constitutional distinctions hinge on the amount of money at stake? I think it'd be again hard to imagine that this is what framers predicted. I think right, the appointments there's various constitutional issues that have been raised, as I understand it, right? A Seventh Amendment issue, right? Article 3 issues, due process issues of the CASE Act. I think the appointments issue is sort of maybe the last thing to worry about. Not that I'm glad to hear from Kevin, but I think as an appointments issue might be sort of thrown in there. But any time, right, you move the adjudication, to a non-Article 3 tribunal, right? All those issues can come up. And, you know, I quickly sort of looked at the analysis from the Copyright Alliance. I didn't find an appointments clause analysis, although I found just about every other constitutional issue that comes up in these contexts. Doesn't mean that it wouldn't have merit. And I believe Zvi mentioned something about merit, but I am honestly not sure. And maybe, maybe it's another pitch for deference from my angle, right? Congress has thought, at least Congress here has thought about the constitutional issues. Whether that's a reason to uphold the system, I'm not sure. But, you know, comparing it to sort of other cases where, Congress is presumed to act in good faith, right? And only if there's animus of bad faith, maybe we'll strike things down. I mean, here it's clear that there was an effort, a thought that went into compliance with appointments clause precedent. I think that should count in favor of Congress in general.
So much like with Mitri, copyright law is not really my area of expertise, but I might be wrong, but last I heard about CASE Act is that the process was voluntary. And so if that's still true, I think it presents an entirely separate set of problems, or perhaps non-problems. Because if it's a voluntary thing, it's almost as if government provides you with free or nearly free or low arbitrators. And you can always go to an arbitrator. You can always go to like a random guy on the street and ask him to settle your dispute. And these are just, these are slightly more sophisticated random guys that are paid for by the government. So, I think in that situation, the appointment clause problem is much more attenuated because, yes, they might still speak on behalf of the government. Yes, they might still cancel your copyright registration or give you too little of a recovery. But ultimately, they only have their power because you've agreed to give them their power in each individual case. If I'm correct, if the CASE Act did come out the same way that I think last I remember it being discussed. Of course, PTAB is not the same way. You can be hailed into PTAB against your wishes. And in fact, while, you know, after having sued somebody in an Article III court kind of as a end run around Article III litigation. So, you know, so I, again, as on the understanding that I have of case act, I think it's much less of a problem. If my understanding is incorrect, then, you know, my answer would change accordingly.
Yeah, maybe you can quickly follow up. The voluntariness point of it is interesting, right? We haven't talked about Freitag and Edmund much. Obviously, they've been, you know, front and center in this litigation. But Scalia and Freitag said, well, there's got to be an element of consent here to the system, or waiver or something. I mean, the patentee has opted into the system. They chose to get a patent. And this came up on other issues, right? Knowing that there's all these re-exams, and that's been in constant flux since, you know, the early 80s. So I'm not sure which way that cuts. I mean, it's not voluntary at that point, but you don't have to get a patent and opt into the patent system, right? The consent point hasn't really come up in this litigation, but I think Scalia's dissent and Freitag, I think his dissent in part or concurrence in part, was actually quite persuasive, right? It's sort of, you chose a tax court. Why are you kind of complaining about it? So, yeah.
Okay. Another question from an anonymous attendee. Several justices seem concerned that a ruling in favor of Arthrex would cause upheaval through the federal government. Do you think there's a path where the court may cabinet's ruling to officers acting in an adjudicatory capacity and say that in those situations, review by a properly appointed principal officer is required?
I mean, I think that ultimately it's not so much about adjudicatory. I think it ultimately goes back to what Dimitri's point was, and where, like I said, where ultimately our level of disagreement is how important the issue is that's being decided. And I think adjudicatory capacity, especially when you're adjudicating people's property rights, and of course, and you know, I know that in Oil State, Justice Thomas wrote for a 7-member majority that these are privileges and these are kind of government-granted government grant monopolies type things. I'm blanking on the specific word that he used. Ultimately, everybody agrees that they, you know, patents have at least some property-like component. Like the statute says it, that they should be treated as personal property. And so when a government actor can act in a way that significantly affects your property rights, I think that's kind of where the flags start going up. How to write it, whether you have to say only adjudicatory capacity or something else, it's a different matter. I mean, I would highlight this, for example, for a lot of, Social Security context, yes, ultimately a lot of things are delegated to the ALJs and then the appeals council, but at the end of the day, decision rests, even though commission does not personally review every single determination, rest with the commissioner. With like ITC, oftentimes you would have, you know, a trial in front of ALJs, but ultimately it's the commission that either affirms or reverses and they have kind of this power of no review. So it's not so much the adjudicatory thing, it's kind of it's this idea that who makes the final determination, including in a adjudicatory context.
Yeah, great question. My administrative law colleagues are certainly concerned because of the upheaval that this decision could cause, right? And well, there are a lot of government officials that perform these decisions. I guess you could call them adjudications. And maybe the harder line is to cabinet adjudication away from other things, right? Since in the Fifth Amendment due process context, right, the right privilege distinction have sort of gone away, and you know, welfare benefits or things like that, it all can be an adjudication, right? So it is every, you know, welfare officer, principal officer, and so on and so forth, right? So these are the questions to ask. I don't think Section 261 resolves the issue or the structure, right? I mean, it can have attributes of personal property, might mean they're just assignable, and that's it. It doesn't mean there's sort of some magic property right there. But I think more importantly, right, is that, you know, a lot of what the government officials do, I mean, can be viewed as adjudication. I mean, yes, here we're applying a lot to the facts, but that comes up in the veterans benefits context, right, as Greg's the Social Security context and so on. And I think, you know, an entitlement to sort of a government grant of some sort in the official deciding whether you're qualified for it, I mean, that is an adjudication, right? So I think adjudication happens everywhere in a government. And, you know, I think we're sort of stuck in this position. Well, are patents more significant for appointments clause purposes than, you know, someone's relief check or something like that? And I mean, it's less money, maybe, but it's maybe that money is important to that person. And does it come down to pure numbers? That's why I think the significance ultimately has to be in policy issues, not these individual resolutions.
So thank you for answering that. And we've made our way through our queue. So I'm going to ask another question that's somewhat related to the last question. If we don't want a cabinet based on adjudication and we need to think about significance and what have you, is it possible that we could or should avoid government upheaval by just saying that patents are weird, the PTAB is weird, and nothing we say in this case has any reach outside of this? So what do you think about cabining this just based on the weirdness of patents and or the PTAB?
Maybe I'll take a shot at it. I mean, I know how I think the court's credibility can sort of be damaged by this approach. Although, I mean, there's definitely reasons to like it. It's sort of a Bush v. Gore's approach. We can't cite it for anything else. And clearly it is getting cited for other things. And you can't just tell parties not to, right? It's whatever kind of comes out of the court. So I think it may be possible to describe the patent system as a weird animal. I think it is obviously true, right? It predates the APA, but I mean, cases like Dickinson v. Zirko and others have brought the patent system into the modern APA framework, and that's been very much the trend, right? And Cuozzo and Thrive, you know, the appealability issues are cross-cutting admin law issues. The court has, you know, has at least tried, right, to sort of have a patent non-exceptionalism in other areas too. So I think, I can see the concern. I can see sort of a narrowly cabined decision, maybe pending a congressional fix. But I think it's hard, sort of once you let the cat out of the bag, right, to sort of limit it to this agency. But I'm not sure. Maybe I didn't clerk in the Supreme Court either. Maybe it's possible to craft a solution that, you know, maybe a good solution, as Kristen suggests, and avoids kind of larger turmoil in a federal government.
So I'm not generally a fan of these chickens good for one ride only coming from the Supreme Court, just because, you know, they take 80 cases, they decline about 8,000. And so the 80 cases that they take have to kind of serve as a guidepost for the 8,000 they don't take. I think Supreme Court has made some decisions that are in patent law that are, if not incomprehensible, at least unilluminating. So we don't really know for example, the 101 decisions. All of us here on this call teach patent law, and I've done it for a number of years now, and I still don't know how to teach 101 because Supreme Court is just kind of made a mess out of this thing. And so I'm not a fan of that kind of saying, look, patent law is a weird animal and therefore we'll just treat it differently. I think Dmitry is right. It would be inconsistent with what they have done over the last decade, at least or so. But also, ultimately, I don't think you need to. I think you can just say that, people who speak for the government on important issues, kind of more than a doctor's appointment, have to either be themselves confirmed by the Senate or have to have their decision, even if in rare cases, but have their decision be reviewable by people who have been confirmed by the Senate. The fact that it doesn't happen very often is fine. It's the fact that that possibility has to be there.
Okay, well, with that, that gets us to the end of our hour. So I want to thank both Greg and Dmitry for this fantastic discussion, and I'm turning it back over to Nick.
Thanks very much, Kristen. I'll just offer a quick thanks to everyone for joining us on behalf of the Federalist Society. Of course, thank you for joining us this afternoon, for our panelists for participating, for Kristen for moderating, for our attendees and your great questions. As always, we welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. Also be checking your email accounts and our website for announcements about upcoming telephone calls and Zoom events like this one. We've got several more oral argument reviews scheduled this week as the court's getting back in session, so be sure to tune into those. Well, thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.